Scripture reading this morning comes to us from the Gospel according to Matthew. Another parable, like last week. We'll be reading from the 13th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, verse 24 through 30, and then skipping down to verse 36 through 43 for its interpretation. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like someone who planted good seed in his field. While people were sleeping, an enemy came and planted weeds among the wheat and went away. When the stalks sprouted and bore grain, then the weeds also appeared. The servants of the landowner came and said to him, "Master, didn't you plant good seed in your field? Then how is it that it has weeds?" "An enemy has done this," he answered. The servants said to him, "Do you want us to go and gather them?" But the landowner said, "No, because if you gather the weeds, you'll pull up the wheat along with them. Let them both grow side by side until the harvest. And at harvest time, I'll say to the harvesters, 'First, gather the weeds and tie them together in bundles to be burned, but bring the wheat into my barn.'" On down to verse 36. Jesus left the crowds and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field." Jesus replied, "The one who plants the good seed is the human one. The field is the world, and the good seeds are followers of the kingdom. But the weeds are followers of the evil ones. The enemy who planted them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the present age. The harvesters are the angels. Just as people gather weeds and burn them in the fire, so it will be at the end of the present age. The human one will send his angels, and they will gather out his kingdom all things that cause people to fall away and all people who sin, and he will throw them into a burning furnace. People there will be weeping and grinding their teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in their Father's kingdom. Let those who have ears hear." Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. It has been said that the road to hell is paved with what? Good intentions. We've heard and perhaps said that phrase many times before. If you do a little bit of research, it dates back to at least the 16th century, probably even earlier. We don't know who wrote it or who said it first. Its meaning, however, is pretty timeless and pretty clear. Much evil has been done, is done, and will be done by people who have the noblest, purest, most innocent, well-meaning of intentions. Just like some of the tourists on May the 9th, 2016 in Yellowstone National Park. The weather was fairly mild. The low that day, May 9th, 2016, was 39 degrees Fahrenheit. The high, about 50 degrees. Pretty normal stuff for that time of year in that place, if you can believe that. Fairly typical spring day for that part of the country. Nevertheless, when two well-meaning tourists, a father and a son, saw a baby bison standing in the middle of the road, shivering and refusing to move, they decided among themselves that it must be cold and that it needed to be rescued. So they loaded this baby bison into the trunk of their car and they drove it to a ranger station. Yes, the trunk of their car. Some of you are going, what? 3 days later, Yellowstone National Park announced that the newborn calf had been euthanized because its mother had rejected it as a result of interference by people. Park rangers tried repeatedly to reunite the newborn bison calf with the herd. These efforts failed, the park said. The bison calf was later euthanized because it was abandoned and causing a dangerous situation by continually approaching people and cars along the roadway. Abandoned calves, the park said, usually starve to death or are killed by predators. And so these well-meaning tourists were seriously worried that the calf was freezing and dying, said a bystander who took a photo of the calf in the tourist trunk, which is available online if you look around. Another tourist said he warned these father and son that their rescue might run afoul of park regulations, but they didn't care. They sincerely thought they were doing a service by helping that calf and trying to save it from the cold. Carissa Reed, a Yellowstone spokeswoman, said in an interview that the tourists acted out of desperation when they took it to the rangers. They were just concerned about the well-being of the animal, she said. That was apparent. She said that the tourists had been given a ticket for $110 and that the National Parks Investigative Service would be conducting further charges. And this last statement by the rangers, which I will share with you, is perhaps the most enlightening in providing a much different perspective than most of us who could have dreamed that such a thing would cause such trouble and death. The rangers later explained that the park, and I quote, isn't a zoo. We don't take care of individual animals. We take care of an entire ecosystem here. Now that father and son only wanted to help that bison. I cannot imagine how sad they must have been to find out that their efforts actually led to the end of that baby bison's life. And so it bears out the statement with which we began and with which this sermon is entitled, that sometimes the road to hell is paved with the best and noblest of intentions. We want to help, but we don't know enough to know what help looks like sometimes. Wild animals are not the only ones harmed by good intentions pursued poorly. In another dilemma, entirely different in nature, our hearts go out, for example, to the innocent people of Syria. They have lived in this country for years under the rule of a sociopathic despot, and when some of them rose in an effort to dethrone him, he responded with a ruthlessness that did not even avoid using poisonous gas. Moved by pictures of children crying and dying from these attacks, our own country, both as a nation and individually, have thrown our support to the rebels in Syria. But to what end? When we helped, for example, the Afghanis throw off Russian control of their country, the end result was that the Taliban rushed in to fill the gap left by the Russian exit. Or in Iraq, the city of Mosul in its final stages of being retaken from ISIS. But this battle, you see, between the U.S., Iraqi, and ISIS forces pursuing different agendas has taken the lives of more than 5,000 civilians and has reduced the historic city to a pile of rubble. In Syria, the scene looks troublingly familiar. What we don't know is who might take control of the country if and when Bashar Hafez al-Assad is removed from power, because ISIS stands in the wings, ready to fill the vacuum once again when the current corrupt government crumbles. But the thing is, we don't have to wait until the war is over to count the cost of our good intentions in Syria. Aleppo is the largest city in Syria with a population of over 2 million people. If you do a Google search, you can find before and after pictures of this once beautiful, once thriving metropolis, and you'll see a city that is in complete ruins today. Over 400,000 people have already died in the fighting, and over 5 million people have fled in search of safety, only to end up in refugee camps where sanitation, nutrition, and the rule of law are in short supply. More than 6.3 million people, it is estimated, are currently displaced. 6.3 million. How can we ever know we are going to do something good then before we actually try to help someone else? Be it a baby bison in Yellowstone National Park, or what we should be doing as a nation or individuals about the terrible injustices we see in Syria or even here in our own country. What about we as parents or grandparents? How do we know that we're going to give good advice to our children or our grandchildren or our children that we teach in vacation Bible school at church and that it will really be helpful? Perhaps this week's gospel story, this parable we read just a moment ago from Matthew 23, can put us on the right track and give us some much needed wisdom. This parable is the second one in the chapter, the second of two seeds parables. The first we discussed last week, a more famous parable that has become known as the parable of the sower. But this parable today takes an entirely different track. A man, you might recall, tills his field and sows seeds in it. And while he sleeps, an enemy of his comes during the night and sows the seeds for weeds into the same field where the wheat was sown just before that. And so later, when the seeds begin to sprout, the man and his workers realize what has happened. The workers are filled with indignation and ask if the master wants them to go into the field and, to the best of their ability, yank up the weeds. But surprisingly, the landowner says no. There are two problems with doing as the workers wish. First, the wheat sprouts are young and tender, and the workers would trample the wheat into the ground and kill them if they walked into the field attempting to collect the weed sprouts. Remember, this is not corn or soybean plants that are neatly planted in rows. This is a field of wheat that kind of grows up like grass every which way. The second problem is that it's early in the growth cycle of the wheat. When the weeds are pulled up, many small wheat plants would also be pulled up along with the wheat. And so clearly the workers are filled with good intentions. But if they follow through on those initial instincts just to jump in there, they may end up doing more harm, the master fears, than good. Better to wait until the wheat and the weeds are all mature, we learn in the story. Then when the harvest is taken, the weeds can be sorted out from the wheat and thrown away. And when Jesus explains the parable in the last verses of the text we read just a few moments ago, there's another lesson that emerges. It's a lesson about judgment. And we who identify ourselves with the wheat are very quick to judge others as the weeds. But the parable reminds us that our responsibility is to grow and let God separate things out. There are still months in between the first sprouts and the harvest. Who knows what will happen between now and then? Judging now is a waste of time and energy in the story and for us. There is a season for stepping up and speaking out for those, who, for example, who are being oppressed. But this is a parable that points out that there's also a season for just concentrating on your own growth, not making any judgments about the weeds out there that you say you're noticing. By the way, have you ever met one single religious person who believes legitimately that they're a weed? I haven't. Church folks, you see, by our own perspective, almost always view ourselves as the wheat in this story, because after all, we're good people, and whoever they are, they're probably not as good as we are, or so we say. You know, someone who is true in our intentions, loyal to our cause, noble in intention, and therefore correct and justified and legitimate as we are, could be considered wheat, but until that is proven, why, most of the time, they, whoever they are, they're either a weed or they might be a weed. That's kind of our default way of thinking, it seems, in religious circles. I'm self-confessing as well. The truth is, though, that Jesus blessed those with his life and his words and in his company, many people who would have been written off by religious folks both then and now as weeds. We don't often take the time to truly get to know someone and their story and end up allowing our own pet peeves, our own notion of pet sins, to color how we feel and think about someone else. What if we changed our default way of viewing others from a weed to wheat? You know, legitimately belonging on equal standing with ourselves. A pastor friend of mine from Colorado, who, by the way, is a die-hard fan of their professional baseball team, the Colorado Rockies, a couple days ago shared his experience about attending a game. It was a home game for the Colorado Rockies when they were playing the Pittsburgh Pirates. Now, I'm not a big baseball fan, but bear with me. This story is wonderful. He said it happened a couple nights ago, and Trevor Williams was the starting pitcher for the opposing team, the Pittsburgh Pirates. And that night he pitched a strong 6 2/3 innings. And the Rockies weren't able to get much going after the first inning because Trevor Williams' pitching was so excellent. At the game, my pastor buddy Ryan said there was this dude sitting, and you have to know Ryan. He said there was this dude sitting in the row behind us. He was a loud, obnoxious Pirates fan. He just kept hooting and hollering, I'm quoting Ryan, every time that Trevor Williams would make a decent pitch. And this dude got really excited every time Trevor Williams struck a guy out. Even on just a decent pitch, he would yell, "Attaboy, T, that's my boy." And said while giving him one standing ovation after another, even on mediocre plays, this guy was nuts for his enthusiasm for Trevor Williams. Remember, this game was being played in Colorado, not Pittsburgh. How dare someone be so enthusiastic for their favorite player or team? This guy's enthusiasm was a little much, he said, for most of us Rockies fans, and this guy was simply obsessed with this pitcher. He said, by the sixth inning, it all made a lot more sense. See, I found out Trevor literally was his boy, his son. Yeah, this professional baseball pitcher's dad was sitting right behind us, and every time I looked back, it made more sense now. This guy was beaming with pride following his son's every single move. His heart obviously filled with fatherly pride, and he was so proud of his boy, he just couldn't keep it to himself, even amongst 40,000 irate Colorado Rockies fans. Trevor Williams left the game after 6 2/3 innings, and after another standing ovation, his dad left the seats. Ryan said, I assumed to go celebrate with his son. And he said, I turned just to confirm it as he walked away, and I saw it right there on the back of his Pirates jersey that he was wearing in the stands. Yep, you can guess what the letters were above the numbers. W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, Williams. I bet he slept well that night. The story is really quite simple, if you think about it. Everyone has a story. And if we can learn to pay attention to other people's stories, we might even end up liking them. They might not even be a weed at all. They might be the wheat. I find that most of the time we end up making inaccurate judgments about others around us because we mischaracterize them. We assume things about other people. We're quick to label those who have different loyalties, kind of like baseball team fans, other than ours. We label them weeds and ourselves as wheat because of a few differences. When ironically, most of the folks at that baseball game were there because they share a certain love for baseball, or at least the people involved in the game. Often we Christians are so inclined to rush to judgment when it comes to the sins of others, we say that we are hating the sin but loving the sinner, and yet those we call sinners rarely see or feel the difference. Yes, we say we love you, but until you become like us, you can't be a member, you can't be a pastor, you can't be an officer, you can't be an insider in our church. The irony of this kind of thinking is, of course, that when they become like us, they'll still be sinners, just with a different set of sins. We'll never have all the facts about the wheat or the weeds, just our own impressions of who's weed and who's a wheat, our own understandings. So maybe we should just step back for a season and focus on our own growth and development and let God sort out the rest. The road to hell may indeed be paved with good intentions, but the road on the way to the kingdom of heaven is most assuredly paved with loving our neighbors at least as well as we love ourselves. And this includes giving our neighbors the benefit of the doubt. Amen.